Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Pull some chairs. Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to this session of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. When the clerk pounded his gavel, he converted this room into a federal courtroom. And the hearing that we're going to conduct today will be conducted with all the same formalities as if we were at our courthouse in Washington, D.C. And so I'd like you to keep that in mind and have your demeanor reflect the seriousness of the occasion. The exception to that will be is that after we have heard the case today and the court adjourns, we will stay on the bench and we will entertain questions from the audience. That's something that we don't normally do and something that you won't normally see any appellate court do. And you can ask questions about the procedures of the court or how the judges got here. You can ask our clerks questions if you want to, or the counsel questions. What you can't ask is any questions about anything to do with the case that we're going to hear. So, without more, we will move on to the case that we have today. That is United States versus McClure. Are counsel ready?
Yes, Your
Honor. Okay.
Yes, Your
Honor. We will hear from the appellant.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Erdman, honorable members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Captain Annie Morgan, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Palomino, we represent Senior Airman McClure. In Martin Linen Supply Company, the Supreme Court stated, a judge is barred from attempting to interfere with a juror's independent judgment in a manner contrary to the interests of the accused. 20 years ago, this court recognized the undisputed right of a jury as a buffer between the accused and the state to reach a verdict despite what may seem clear law. Panel members have the authority to nullify.
But wasn't Martin Linen Company a double jeopardy case, and wasn't what the court was saying there, the quote that you're relying on, more or less dicta, although it's probably a sound reflection of the law, it wasn't at the heart of that case.
Your Honor, it is contained in dicta within the opinion, but it is instructive on this issue, which is speaking to the primary responsibility of a jury and a panel in our case, which is to stand between the accused and the potentially abusive nature of the government and the prohibition on the military judge from interfering with that.
So you're not arguing that Martin Linen is controlling, just that it has a persuasive statement of the law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
When the military judge in appellant's case instructed the panel that they must convict and only convict appellant if they were convinced of his guilt, he stripped the panel of their authority, and that demands reversal.
How did he strip him of his authority if the military judge, through the standard instructions, made it clear that the panel member's responsibility was first to decide whether, beyond a reasonable doubt, the accused was guilty of the offense?
Your Honor, it's a two-prong analysis. It is recognized, and this court has recognized, the panel has the authority to nullify. And so long as we have general verdicts, they will retain that power to nullify.
I don't think we've said that they have the authority. I think that we've said that they have the power to do it. They have the raw power, that they have the incidental ability to do it. We haven't said that there's a right, that the accused has a right for them to nullify.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is not the accused's right to have a panel that nullifies.
I mean, I think the point is we can't stop them, right? And even if they reach a verdict based on jury nullification, we can't reverse it. It stays in place. That's very different than what you're asking for.
Your Honor, I believe that it's contained within the structure of a general verdict system that we ask jurors to go back into a secretive deliberation room and apply facts, law, and their conscience. And the idea that they may reach those elements necessary to find guilt and still inherently choose to vote not guilty is within their prerogative, it is within their authority.
Well, we've held that you have no, whatever the ambiguous status of the act of nullification is, we've held clearly that you have no right, number one, you have no right to nullification, and number two, you have no right to an instruction on nullification.
You're
so, I repeat, Judge, how is this a directed verdict in any way?
Your Honor, appellant takes no issue with the holding in Hardy, and the holding in Hardy turned on the question of whether or not an appellant had a right to have a panel instructed.
Mm-hmm.
The question here is distinct from that. The question is whether or not the military judge may instruct improperly. Had the military judge...
No, the question is whether the military judge may use this formulation. That assumes the result. How does this formulation direct a verdict in the context of an instruction that makes it explicit to the members that they are the triers of fact and they have to come find him beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, when the military judge instructed that they must convict and only convict, that was an incomplete...
He didn't say an only convict. He said they must convict.
Correct, Your Honor. When the military judge said that he must convict, he exceeded those mandatory instructions that are encompassed within Article 51.
Well, that's a different argument. And where have we ever held that Article 51 is all-encompassing and you've got to give Article 51 everything in there and nothing else?
This court hasn't, as far as Pelham is aware, this court has not specifically addressed the question of whether or not Article 51 is all-encompassing. However, Article 51C2 discusses, Article 51C discusses the mandatory instructions that a military judge must provide prior to the members entering their deliberations, and Article 51C2 discusses that they must be instructed that if they are not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, they must acquit. What the military judge then did is created this paradigm where he put the must convict language on the same footing. And that was improper because it is both an incomplete and an inaccurate statement of law. While the members should convict or had or could convict, they were not required to. They very well could enter those that deliberation room and return a verdict of not guilty. And that
you're
would
making
be
it sound as if this particular military judge came up with this formulation. Wasn't it, in fact, the standard bench book instruction?
Your Honor, it was not the standard bench book instruction. That came from the Army immediately on the footfalls of this court's decision in Meeks. This came from the Air Force's electronic bench book.
Which is based on the, which appears to be based precisely on the Federal Judicial Center's pattern criminal jury instruction that Justice Ginsburg lauded and praised in her concurrence in Victor versus Nebraska.
And Your Honor,
as the most clear exposition of a reasonable doubt instruction that she had seen.
And Your Honor, I think it's important to draw a distinction between this court's recommendation and Meeks, where in fact the court, where in fact the trial judge recommended or instructed should. When the court dropped that footnote in Meeks, what they were actually dealing with was the moral certainty language. And so the footnote is an attempt to come up with a single instruction for all of the armed forces. And at that time, that was a very reasonable instruction because, as you mentioned, Your Honor, it came from the Lincoln v. Nebraska case, which came from the federal judicial panel. 30 years later, we have now had this issue litigated throughout the federal circuits, and the landscape has changed with the majority of the federal circuits weighing in either in favor of not providing a definition of reasonable doubt or instructing should. So,
But have any federal circuit courts found that it's a reversible error for a trial court to use the word must?
No, Your Honor.
Well, that gets us to another question. There was no objection at the trial, so even if this is error, it has to be plain and obvious. And so what's your argument that this would be a plain and obvious error?
Your Honor, appellant would disagree with a plain error standard of review and would assert that it's a de novo standard of review under this court's opinion in United States v. Miller. And what Miller stood for is the proposition that the military judge bore the responsibility for ensuring that mandatory instructions are given and given accurately, and would state that waiver was inapplicable. Miller involved a judge failing to give a standard sentencing instruction without an objection. And as this also...
What if we think that this is a standard instruction?
That in deviating without explanation that this...
But you said it was taken from the Air Force's online instructions.
Correct, Your Honor.
And this is an Air Force case.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's appellant's position that this so materially changed the structure of Article 51 and those mandatory instructions that it would constitute plain error.
Well, that puts me back to my original question. Have we ever held that Article 51 clears the field?
No.
Those instructions have to be given and absolutely nothing else can be given?
No, Your Honor, but
appellant... And as far as a lack of uniformity is concerned, is that a matter for us, or is it a matter for the Joint Service Committee?
Your Honor, it is a matter for the Joint Service Committee, but it's also a matter for this court to address, and this court did address in Meeks and was resolved immediately following Meeks with the publication of the Department of the Army pamphlet with a standard instruction that stood the test of time for 30 years before the Air Force inexplicably changed the instruction.
Well, are the Army's regs binding on the Air Force?
They're not, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, then, so we've got a lack of uniformity.
However, Your Honor, I would point out that this court has at the very least recognized the persuasive authority that is contained within the military judge's bench book.
What's the formal status of these electronic instructions? I mean, there was a lot of talk about the Army bench book, and that was used to be or generally what the Air Force followed, and now they have this. Has this electronic format been formally adopted by the Air Force?
No, Your Honor. The Air Force's Air Force Instruction 51201 directs litigants to refer to the Army Military Judges Bench Book for at least drafting specifications and logically would then follow for instructions. There is no reference to the Air Force's electronic bench book, nor does it appear that the Air Force has subjected its bench book to any type of scrutiny, review, and has not made attempts to codify it through Air Force instruction.
So go ahead. So it's just hanging out there?
It appears to be, Your Honor.
So here's a question. You seem to take issue with the word, use of the word must, because you think that it directs a verdict. Do you similarly take issue with the part of the formulation that says if you think there's a real possibility that he is not guilty, you must give him the benefit of the doubt and find him not guilty? Should that also be should or may or could?
No, Your Honor, because the mandatory instructions presume innocence and presume that if the government does not prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the members must acquit. The same does not exist about whether or not members are required to return a verdict of guilt. And so in instructing must, appellant's primary concern is that this is an inaccurate statement of law. The members have the prerogative.
Would you agree that your conclusion that it's an inaccurate statement of the law is that somehow there's some inherent right, legal right, of a member to disregard the law and disregard the judge's instructions and base a finding of not guilty, come to a finding of not guilty, even though he has found that the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that he will nonetheless say you are not guilty, even though I think you're guilty?
Your Honor...
Because, I mean, it sounds like that's what you're saying, and it seems like a rather lawless system that you're propounding.
Well, and, Your Honor, given the military judge's instructions that discuss voting in accordance with your conscience, this doesn't become contrary. Because had our military justice system not accounted for this, then we would merely have the direction to the members, you must vote in accordance with the law and the facts. But we don't. We give them three charges. We tell them they must vote in accordance with the law, the facts, and their conscience.
So you think that your conscience part doesn't mean, as opposed to being pushed around or persuaded by the other people on the panel?
Your Honor, I believe that it's open to interpretation. And certainly, if there is a concern of lawlessness, we have a unique facet to the military in Article 25, where we select our members based in part on their judicial temperament. And so to the extent that we would have a concern perhaps in the civilian sector about this lawlessness, this chaos or anarchy, that is diminished in the military.
Well, what about the the charge that they need to follow the military judge's instructions and that they need to apply the law as he explains it to them. I mean, you are asking for two separate things. You're asking for a system where, like all other systems, members, jurors, have to listen to the instructions that they're given by the judge and follow those instructions, even if they disagree with them.
And, Your Honor, I believe appellant's request is even more simple than that, and it's that the military judge not be allowed to improperly instruct them. And so,
but this is a circular argument because you're assuming that it's improper instruction, and that's the very question that we're answering.
And
you can point us to no case that says it's an improper instruction or that it is plain error or constitutional error or any error at all to
and
give the instruction that was given.
And so, Your Honor, the best, by way of example, is had we intended for this to be proper, had the military justice system intended for this, we would have special verdicts. And the members would go back to the deliberation room and they would vote on the facts based on the evidence they've received in the military judge's law and the law they received from the military judge. And then they would come out and deliver that to the military judge and the military judge would enter a verdict. But that is not the system that we have in place. We have a general verdict system in place, and so long as we have that general verdict in place, then members have a raw power. And so to tell them that raw power does not exist is incorrect.
How are you drawing a distinction between the military system and many civilians, federal, some states, have used must, no reversible error? How are you drawing a distinction here? Are you saying that service members are automatically entitled to enhanced protection?
Your Honor, words matter. And in the military context, must is an order. And so I'm not advocating for military due process. It is in the military context that we must appreciate. The military members are told they must do something.
Must?
Words matter. When military members are told they must do something, it is an order, and there is no discretion to that. And so it's in that context where the military judge issues these hortatory commands that there is an enhanced significance where if this is not improper in the civilian context, as the federal courts have held, it is improper in our military context.
But I guess the problem I'm having, counsel, is that you know, that it seems to me that the way that the instructions work and the way that the law works, right, is that if a member finds that someone is guilty beyond reasonable doubt of all the elements of a charge, right, that they must convict them, right? And that's the instruction and that's the law. And then there's a recognition, right, that no matter what they're told, we can't stop them from disregarding what they've been told to do and engaging in jury nullification because their deliberations are secret and we can't peer into their minds. And even if they come out later and tell everyone, well, we knew he was guilty and we just decided, you know, we couldn't stand a prosecutor, so we're letting the guy off, right? That there's nothing to be done about it, right? That finding of not guilty is unassailable and stands, right? But that's a different question than whether or not telling them that if they find someone's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that it's wrong to say that they must find him guilty.
Your Honor, I noticed that my time is...
You can respond to the question.
And Your Honor, I would just go back to the Article 51 argument, which is the codification of the Constitution within our constitutional rights within our system. And 51 laid out three very clear musts. Must presume innocence, must assume guilt if the government, or must find not guilty if the government did not prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and must find a lesser degree of guilt for which there is no reasonable doubt. That what the government has attempted to do here is assert a fourth must, and the government does not have a right to a verdict of guilty, and it's improper to put into that statutory scheme that which Congress did not intend, and where Congress has not placed it in, we must presume that they did not intend for it to be there.
Counsel, I have one additional question. You're arguing, focusing on one word and one instruction, but the military judge gave numerous instructions on the government's burden. And isn't there an argument that when all of those instructions, of which you have no objection to, that set forth the government's burden in different iterations, once we look at the entire mass of instructions, that the jury understood what his job was and what the burden was on the government?
Your Honor, I don't think we can know that, and I think there are several problematic phrases within the reasonable doubt instruction to include the firmly convinced language and the real possibility of innocence language. And I think that when you take that in totality and apply some of the skepticism that the Fourth and Seventh Circuits have applied to that language, there is a real possibility that the members were confused and did not properly apply these instructions.
Okay, thank you. You'll have additional time on rebuttal. The court will now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. The real question before this court today is not one of policy. The real question is whether the reasonable doubt instruction given in this case was error, and more specifically, whether or not it was plain error. The short answer is that the instruction in this case was not erroneous, plainly or otherwise. The instruction did not amount to an impermissible directed verdict, and it was a correct statement of the members' duty to follow the law. Appellant has no right to a panel that was willing to disregard the military judge's instructions or to engage in jury nullification. Now, I want to start off with the argument that this was a directed verdict, because it certainly was not in this case. The way that the instruction was presented to the members, it was presented as a contingency. If based on their consideration of the evidence, they were firmly convinced of appellant's guilt, then they were required or they must convict him. But immediately after that, the military judge also charged them that if there was a real possibility that the accused was not guilty, then that they also must acquit him. So in that context, it was very clear, it should have been very clear, and it must have been very clear to the members what exactly their duties were.
Well, counsel, if, as assuming arguendo, the appellant's argument that you have some sort of inchoate right to jury nullification, you know, and we can't know, it's not defined, we've held explicitly that there's no right to an instruction on it, but because it's a general verdict, we can't know. If there's some sort of inchoate right, or maybe what the appellant is saying is there's some sort of inchoate right to not have the judge interfere with this inchoate right, I don't know. And the judge says, no, you must find, you know, nullification assumes, arguendo, that they did find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they should convict. And then they say, nah, I didn't like that guy, and I'm gonna let him go anyway. So, how do you answer the argument that that's really what's? It's not so much an argument that, as I understand it, that the judge is directing a verdict, but that the judge is preventing is instructing them not to exercise this inchoate right.
And I think the fundamental problem here is that there isn't a right to jury nullification, and that's exactly what this court held.
Well, that's why I use the term inchoate.
So imagine that there was.
But you're not arguing that they don't have the authority, the power.
They have the raw power. That is correct. This court recognized that. And Hardy, there are many reasons why that's a raw power. I mean, we can't go back and ask them what happened in their deliberations. We can't punish them if we don't like that the verdict that they came forward with. Those are all reasons why they have the raw power. But again, it's not a right. And so I think...
But appellant seems to be arguing that this instruction takes that authority away, that the military judge is saying, not in so many words, but essentially, you don't have that authority, that if you find the appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, you must find them guilty, which flies in the face of, I'm not sure jury nullification is really an appropriate term, because juries have that power to go into the deliberation room and search their conscience and come out with a verdict. And as you say, we don't know what the reasons are.
Well, I think, Your Honor, if we look at the federal circuits who have addressed this issue, they've been very uniform that in saying that this concept, if we want to call it jury nullification or whatever, it's not something that should be encouraged. There's no reason to tell the panel members that they have this raw power. I mean, we recognize that there's nothing that we can do about it if it in fact happens, but certainly the federal courts suggest that to allow this or to somehow promote it, you're headed down the road towards chaos and anarchy.
Do you think that it's fair to make a distinction between saying that they have the authority to do it and saying that they have the raw power to do it? Because authority suggests that it's somehow encouraged or that it's correct or that it's a right that they have, and raw power suggests that it's just something that they can do. We can't do anything about it.
I think that that is an important distinction to make, Your Honor, and I think that certainly if you look at the cases that have interpreted jury nullification, they certainly would be on the side of calling this a raw power rather than something that, yes, that they are authorized to do. Certainly, the contention seems to be across the board that we tolerate this. It's a tolerable anomaly, I think, is what one of the courts called it. But in fact, what should be happening is that the court should be instructing the members that they must follow the law in this particular case. And if we look at, or I'm sorry, in all of these criminal cases, but if we look at this particular case and the instruction that was given, that's exactly what the instruction amounted to. It amounted to telling the court members that they must follow the law in this particular case.
Well, what do we do about if in fact, must is the appropriate term to use? There's an argument that the appellant has raised that in the Air Force's instructions in capital cases, they don't use must, they use should. Is that correct? Is that allegation correct?
That is correct from looking at the Air Force electronic bench book, and I cannot, Your Honor, speak to the reason for the difference, but I will point out that we often see a lot of differences in trying capital cases as opposed to just trying at your typical general court-martial.
But the point is the Air Force itself is internally inconsistent in its use of these terms. And if should is so bad, particularly in a capital case, it's endorsed by the Air Force.
That is true, although I will say, Your Honor, that the military judge in a particular case has the ability, he or she is not bound in any way by the military judge's bench book. So certainly it would be within the military judge's authority in a capital case to choose the must language. And I think it's also important to look at Victor v. Nebraska, where the Supreme Court spoke
to. That kind of detracts from your argument that this is in the bench book, must is in the bench book, and that's why it's a good thing.
Well, I wouldn't say that that's the heart of my argument, Your Honor. I think it's for when we're looking at the concept of plain error, what's in the bench book is certainly persuasive. But I think that the government has much more persuasive arguments in this particular, for this particular instruction, especially when we look at all of the federal circuits who have endorsed this instruction, or at the very, very least said that it's not reversible error.
Go ahead.
Is it the government's position that it ought to be must, that it ought to be uniform? The appellant seems to be arguing that one of these problems is it's not uniform among the services. Does the government care, or is the government simply arguing that must is permissible?
Well, the government's position is that must is the better instruction to use. However, I don't believe that there is any requirement whatsoever that there be uniformity.
Okay, it's not the government's position then.
The government
is arguing that must is permissible.
Correct.
We don't need to go any further than that.
Well, certainly if you wanted, Your Honor, to say that must was a great instruction,
that's why I asked the appellant.
Right.
Whether this was a matter for us or the JSC.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I do think it's important to answer the question of whether or not this is error.
Not the narrow question in this case,
right,
but the policy question.
Well, certainly I think that this is not a policy debate as to which instruction is preferred.
Don't you think there is a benefit to having a uniform approach to this throughout the services? I mean, you're arguing, both parties are arguing, that there is a difference between must and should in this instance. And that difference may make a difference in a case. And so shouldn't there be a uniform application?
I think it would be okay, but I think it's not required, Your Honor. I mean, if we look at Victor v. Nebraska, where the Supreme Court said that there's no constitutional right to any particular reasonable doubt instruction. And so, therefore, you look at it, you could be tried in federal...
But that doesn't address the fact that we are operating in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And one of Congress's intentions in that was that service members accused of a crime will be treated uniformly across the services.
I do think there may be some value to that, but ultimately I do think that the authority should rest with the military judge, because we look to Article 36, where Congress gave the president right to prescribe additional procedural rules, and then we look at what the president has said about this, and the president has essentially given the ultimate authority in deciding what instructions are right for a particular case to the military judge. And so to the extent it's uniform, perhaps that's a goal, but I don't believe that's
so
the overarching best goal.
What would be the particular circumstances that would justify a military judge from deviating from the instruction in the bench book, whichever bench book you want to choose in this case? What would be the reasons?
Well,
what would justify a change?
Your Honor, I just thinking off the top of my head, maybe you have an army case, and maybe there was something that was talked about during voir dire that gave the military judge some pause, that there was a member who might not follow the law. For some reason, the member was not excused during voir dire. Perhaps in a situation such as that, the military judge would say, I think that we need an instruction that is very clear here that the members have to apply the law in the case.
You're conceding there is a difference between the must and the should application of this.
Well, I do, Your Honor, and I think that must is preferable. If we look at the Supreme Court of New Jersey, they have said in discussing this issue that really the only possible consequence of using should is that some court members or jurors might get in their head that jury nullification is permissible. And for the number of federal courts and state courts that have very clearly said that jury nullification is something that trial courts should, in fact, try to prevent. If we take that into consideration, then must is certainly the preferable language rather than
should. Like policy arguments, do we as a court need to make the distinction between must and should to answer the question in this case?
No, Your Honor, you absolutely do not.
And I think that a question that someone else had that I'm not sure that you answered is what is the government's view as to whether that policy question or determination should be made by this court or by the Joint Services Committee? I think it was Judge Stuckey's question. I'm not sure that you answered it.
And I think, Your Honor, and Judge Stuckey, that it the policy should be in the hands of the JSC. This court should be looking at whether or not this particular instruction was error. And certainly we contend that it was not error, and it certainly was not plain error. I do want to address the argument that was made by appellant as far as the need for additional safeguards in the military. And appellant seems to have a fear that military members who are so conditioned to follow orders are somehow going to hear this instruction and somehow take it or interpret it as a directed verdict. But there's really no reasonable likelihood of that. When we look at all of the instructions in the context, and indeed the Supreme Court has said that when courts are interpreting jury instructions, you don't just take them in isolation. You just don't take a sentence out of them. You look at the entire jury instructions as a whole. And if we look at everything that the members were instructed in this case, it just simply isn't reasonable to believe that somehow these military members got confused. We look at military members, as appellant's counsel mentioned, they are selected based on Article 25 criteria. So they are the best and most qualified. We look at how educated our military members are as compared to probably the general population that you might get in a federal court. And our military members, they have degrees. The officers all have degrees. Many of the enlisted members have degrees, even master's degrees as well. And so we're talking about a very well-educated set of members, and they are not likely to be confused in this case. So I think that fear by the appellant is putting forward is certainly unfounded. But also,
Counsel, before you get to the end here, just so I understand what the position is it that there's no distinction between must and should, but that either one is okay, or there's no problem with either one?
Your Honor, I don't believe that either instruction is error per se. Certainly, I think that must more accurately captures what the member's duties are. But some of the opinions that you will read that talk about must versus should say really, from the way that a member, or I'm sorry, from the way someone might be interpreting them, at the end of the day, there is not that big of a difference, although they do point out that the language should is more likely to potentially put in a juror's mind that jury nullification is acceptable or it's something that they can do. So the government's position, again, Your Honor, is not that neither is error, but must is certainly preferable. Okay.
What's your response to the appellant's argument that this isn't a plain air case?
I don't believe that that is backed up by the law. I think that this court has been very clear that when there has not been an objection at trial, that it's plain air. I certainly don't think that somehow there's something inherent in reasonable doubt instructions that would call for a different type of review when there hasn't been an objection. It seems like the Federal Circuit cases have also applied plain error when there hasn't been an objection at trial. So I absolutely believe that it is a plain error review that should be conducted. Now, this court in Hardy took up the question of whether or not the military is different, and somehow the military calls for a different rule when it comes to jury nullification. And what the court in Hardy actually said was, even if in the civilian sector it was somehow permissible or jury nullification was recognized, they would have extreme hesitation about applying that rule to the military. And one of the things that they point to is, number one, the need to maintain good order and discipline. It's hard to maintain good order and discipline in a system when our military members might believe that they can just disregard the rules that were given to them by Congress and given to them by the president. The second thing that the court in Hardy talked about was the whole concept of civilian control of the military. And so we have to look back to the framers of the Constitution who put the military in the hands of the civilian sector. They gave Congress the ability to support and raise armies. They designated the president as the commander in chief. And so what this court in Hardy said was to say that, or to give military members some sort of authoritative basis to disregard those laws that were put into place by Congress, or that were the rules put into place by the president, to do that would be completely contrary to the concept of civilian control of the military. And I think that is an important thing for this court to continue to consider today. What we want to be doing in the military justice system is to encourage court members to follow the law, and this must instruction does this. And that's why in this case that it is not error. The last thing that I would like to touch on is the concept of prejudice in this case. So even if this court were to find that this instruction was plain error, again, if we look at the instructions as a whole, appellant in this case suffered no prejudice from the instructions that were given. We look at everything as a whole, what the military judge told the members. The members were instructed on the presumption of innocence. It was emphasized that the government had the burden of proof and that burden of proof never shifted to appellant. It was the member's sole province to determine guilt, and the military judge specifically told them, if there's anything that I said that may have given you the impression as to my opinion as to guilt, you must disregard that. The members were instructed that each and every offense had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and were instructed that any doubt had to be resolved in favor of appellant. In light of all those instructions, any plain error in the instruction that told the members that they must convict appellant simply did not cause him prejudice. The members in this case clearly understood that this was not a directed verdict and that they were allowed to acquit appellant because they did, in fact, acquit him of one of the charges in the case. And so if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Please.
The military judge did not commit error or plain error in instructing the members in this case. Even if the instruction somehow constituted plain error, appellant suffered no material prejudice to a substantial right. As such, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does appellate have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, 3 points on rebuttal. First, addressing Judge Sparks' question, must versus should are not the same. And when the federal panel issued the...
I think she said that they're not the same. She just said that neither is error.
Neither is error. Must is error. And I think we can look at the federal circuits, perhaps not having found reversible error, but look at the way they've changed their panel instructions to find that. Because 30 years ago, when a model instruction was proposed, it was adopted and it was used throughout the federal court system. However, if we look at the federal court system today, almost every circuit, and I apologize, the majority of the circuits have opined that either reasonable doubt should not be instructed, or if you're going to instruct, you should instruct should.
Does appellate defense ask the Joint Services Committee to change this instruction or to issue a rule about what the instruction should be?
No, Your Honor. However, if it's going to be a policy issue, that would be for Congress to modify Article 51. Appellant would ask this court to fulfill.
Well, that's if you're correct that 51 is basically the universe of things it must can be directed at, right?
Understood, Your Honor. Appellant would ask this court to fulfill the vision in Meeks. Meeks understood that having varying instructions related to reasonable doubt among the services was problematic and made a recommendation for a uniform instruction based on that problematic nature.
The counsel, for the horrible which you're conjuring up to happen, you would have to have members who, number one, are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the accused's guilt. Number two, nonetheless decide that because trial counsel has bad breath or whatever reason, we're going to acquit him. But then number three say, oh, but we can't do that because the judge said must. That seems pretty illogical. If they get from one to two and say, we're going to acquit him because trial counsel has bad breath, do you think what the judge says is going to make any difference? They're already not following instructions. So we're going to square the circle. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I know something running long.
Please respond.
Your Honor, jury nullification recognizes that there's principles of lenity and equity that go into the jury rendering.
Well, lenity's something else, but
go ahead. And it's for any number of scenarios. So to engage in what exactly the members would have to find in this case to determine that elements are met, but they're going to acquit, whether it's based on residual doubts, whether it's based on policy perspectives, is to engage in full speculation. But there is a raw power to do that, and it's a buffer, and that buffer was recognized in Hardy, and here in this case the military judge interfered with that buffer. And what Martin Lennon said is that the military judge can't interfere with that independent judgment. And while we may not have a definition of what conscience means in those three charges to our members, it sounds an awful lot like independent judgment. And so that's where the violation occurred in this case.
Counsel, we have additional questions.
I just have a real quick question. How do you respond to trial counsel, the government's point that, you know, you're concerned that you must convict, you know, will take all freedom of thought away from the members, but in fact, despite having received that instruction in this case, they didn't convict on everything. There was an acquittal. How do you respond to that point?
Your Honor, I think that's a red herring. I think whether
doesn't it directly disprove the parade of horribles that you're concerned with?
No, Your Honor, because it would assume that they had found the elements for the prior charge, and that was a separate consideration. So just because they found the elements for this charge, it does not mean they would not have exercised that independent judgment with regards to the second specification.
Fair enough.
Chief Judge, can I ask one additional question as well? Captain Morgan, pardon me if I might be going over treaded ground already, but I think you earlier said, correct me if I'm wrong, this is not a plain error case?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, then how do you articulate the prejudice? And maybe you mentioned that earlier, and I'm sorry if I missed it.
No, Your Honor, assuming a de novo review, at least one case stands for the proposition that where there's a deficient reasonable doubt instruction, all findings will be reversed. And that comes from Sullivan v. Louisiana, and that's appellant's position, is that the military judge's instruction in this case rendered the reasonable doubt instruction deficient.
Okay, so your prayer for relief would be
reversal.
The reversal of all of the findings.
Yes.
Okay, thank
you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned until further notice of the court.
The court stands adjourned until further notice of the court.